Welcome to the Unfiltered Podcast with me, special guest host Dr. Johnny Rees, and powered by Ultimate Performance, the world's premier personal training experience that delivers maximum results in minimum time. In each episode of the Unfiltered Podcast, we speak to the most respected, celebrated, and controversial experts in the fields of health, fitness, nutrition, well-being, and performance to help you find the life-changing advice you need to live smarter. Remember, you can find all our exclusive Unfiltered documentaries, video interviews, and investigations at unfilteredonline.com and the Unfiltered Extra YouTube channel. And now, on with the show. I am here today with Dr. Tommy Wood. Tommy, thank you so much for joining me. How are you today?
I'm very good, thank you. And thanks for having me. I'm really excited to be here and chat with you.
Yeah, well, I'm super excited to dig in. And you have this incredible wealth of knowledge, particularly relating to the brain and brain health and all those sorts of things. So I guess I'd like to kick off, and I appreciate this is quite a broad question, but just sort of kick off by asking you about the most important lifestyle factors for brain health, brain performance, and longevity. I appreciate those might be slightly different, but sort of lifestyle factors for brain health.
I think all those topics you mentioned actually do coalesce around some core factors that I believe are very important for brain health. And we have now a pretty huge breadth and wealth of research to support that. The way I think about this in general is in three buckets. And to step back briefly, one thing that I would like the audience to take away is an appreciation that the brain is capable of adapting and improving pretty much throughout the entire lifespan, right? We're told this story that as we get older, we lose brain cells. We're just going to get, you know, we're going to lose cognitive function over time. There's nothing we can do about it. And that's just like, frankly, completely untrue. There's certainly more inertia to create changes in the brain as you get older, but that's just because the brain is a product of your environment. You've already shaped it a certain amount. So you don't want it to just like suddenly change itself, right? Because you want your brain to be adapted to you and your lifestyle, but it certainly can change and you can learn new skills, improve brain health, improve brain function pretty much for the majority of your life. If not, you know, as long as you don't get into sort of late stage dementia, there certainly seems to be ongoing capacity to change and improve. The three main buckets that I think about, and I think about them in buckets because it potentially helps people to think about how the brain functions, or at least a framework for thinking about how the brain functions. And then also helps you to identify, you know, maybe one area where you might want to focus yourself, and it's not the same for everybody. So the most important driver of cognitive function, in my opinion, and I've written papers about this with a good friend of mine, Dr. Josh Turknet, who's a neurologist. What seems to drive the function of the brain is how we use our brain. And this is often sort of, you know, we kind of know about this, right? You know, when you retire, you have to do some Sudoku to keep your brain engaged, that kind of stuff. But I think fundamentally, it's much more important than that. And it's just like exercise. And the brain responds to challenge in the same way that the body does respond to physical exercise. So if you want to be bigger and stronger, either lift more weights at the gym, go faster in a marathon, right? You have to train and you have to push past the sort of limits of your current capabilities. That drives adaptations and then that augments your physiology and you're able to perform better, right? The brain is essentially exactly the same. And so the most important thing that I, you know, the drives brain function is how we use our brains. Are we continuing to challenge and stimulate the brain to drive the adaptations that we want? Are we developing the skills that we want our brain to be good at? And are we continuing to do that throughout our entire lifespan? Like that's bucket one. And I think that's sort of like the primary driver, right? Just like if you want to get bigger and stronger, you need to go lift weights in the gym. But then if you want to gain the most benefits of lifting weights in the gym, other things become important. And so in the brain, I think about what I call a supply bucket. So this bucket is things like making sure you can get oxygen and glucose or other metabolic substrates for energy to the brain. So that means you need good cardiovascular function. You need your arteries and your heart to be functioning well. So you need to be aerobically fit. have good, you know, overall cardio metabolic health. And then you need to have the nutrients that are used to generate, you know, cell membranes and all the other structures that you use when you're trying to get neurons to make new connections. So then things that are really important are omega-3 fatty acids, B vitamins. We know that iron and vitamin D are also really important for like neurotransmitter production. So that's the other bucket, right? So healthy supplies. So that's healthy peripheral health, good cardiovascular health, good nutrient status. And then the final bucket is what I call the support bucket. And that is, first of all, giving time for the adaptations to occur. And this occurs during sleep. Again, I'll keep going back to the exercise analogy because you don't get bigger in the gym, you get bigger when you rest, right? And like that's when the muscles repair themselves and they come back bigger and stronger. And the brain is the same. So we need adequate sleep for these adaptations to challenge to occur. And then we want to avoid things that kind of inhibit that beneficial adaptation process. So this can be excessive alcohol, smoking, things that cause chronic inflammation. So like dental disease is a common one. Other chronic inflammatory conditions, chronic stress can play a role here. Air pollution is increasingly being appreciated as something that can do that. So those are kind of the three buckets that I think of. And then from there, you can figure out, well, which of those things does it sound like I'm maybe not paying attention to? And then that you can start to figure out what you might want to then work on if you want to support your long-term brain health.
I think that's a fantastic overview. And I think it's really encouraging as well, because there's a lot that's within your control there, essentially,
yeah,
right?
Absolutely.
There's so many things that we can do, and you've just highlighted, you know, quite a few of them. That I suppose for people who are very concerned about cognitive decline, and as you said, thinking it's sort of, oh, it's inevitable, I'm just getting a bit older. Well, perhaps, as you just mentioned, it's not inevitable, and there are all sorts of things that you can do to address it. So in terms of other, I've heard you talk about, you mentioned Sudoku and things like that. People will say, oh, I'm playing Sudoku. Is that sort of thing? And I noticed that you actually mentioned some similar sort of Wordle type thing in your daily routine.
Yeah.
Is that likely to make a big difference, or will it be more sort of language learning that would be better or more beneficial in this case?
So there's nothing wrong with Sudoku, but it's definitely not the kind of challenge that I'm thinking of. There are some studies that actually show that things like Sudoku and crosswords and things like that, they have more of a benefit, like similar to things like mindfulness and meditation. It's almost like this sort of like relaxing, slightly unfocused state. And that can be beneficial, absolutely, right? We know that can help mitigate stress and things like that. So Sudoku in that context works well. But if we're thinking about really challenging the brain, stimulating change, then you mentioned learning new languages, learning new physical activities, particularly like sports that have a coordination component, or some people call that open skill sports, learning a musical instrument, things that require social interaction, right? These are the challenging skills that really drive human brain development in the first place, right? You think about a baby developing new motor skills, new language skills, new social skills. That's what really shapes our brains to begin with. And our brain really responds to those. Any time later in life, we see cognitive function improve when we have people learn new languages late in life, when people take up resistance training late in life, when people learn musical instruments late in life. It's these kinds of skills and challenges that I think are really going to drive brain health. And just like physical activity, you probably do them, you know, a few times a week, and you can only really work hard at it for, you know, 30 to 90 minutes, right? It's hard to sort of push the edges of your current capacity. And so anything that you're doing all day long, doing the same thing again and again, right, that's not the kind of challenge that I'm thinking about. It's these concerted efforts to build skills that are driving improved capacity in the brain.
So it's that sort of novel, is that right? That sort of novel element to it. And I think you said something else that's really encouraging, or certainly that I found very encouraging, that it's actually good to suck in America.
Oh, yeah.
It's good to not be very good at stuff, right? Because that's actually more beneficial. I was wondering if you could explain a little bit more about that.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's a few parts of that. The first part is why I think we see, you know, traditionally in Western or modernized cultures, we see this decline in cognitive function over the lifespan, is that we don't continue to learn new skills primarily because we don't like doing things that we're bad at. Absolutely right. Adults hate to see other people, adults hate for other people to see them fail, whereas kids don't mind, right? They have no problem with that whatsoever. So one of the reasons why I believe we see this cognitive decline is because we're actively not doing these things that challenge the brain. And when you're learning new skills, actually being bad at it and the frustration that comes with it, you know, you release things like noradrenaline and some other neurotransmitters that actually create the situation that helps support neuroplasticity, which is the development of new connections in the brain. So being bad at it and, you know, a little bit of frustration is beneficial. If you get like really frustrated, you won't sort of be focusing in it or on the task in the same way. But that creates this environment for neuroplasticity because you're telling your brain, this is an important thing and I'm bad at it. And that tells the brain, okay, well, I need to start developing connections in order to improve my function here. So novelty, skills that you're bad at, and generally it's the first part of skill development where you see most of the benefit. So, right, imagine you're an expert level musician getting a little bit better at something you're already very good at, probably not going to have the same benefit as doing a completely new thing that you've never done before and getting a little bit good at it. So that's why focusing on things that you suck at can be really beneficial for the brain.
Yeah, I think that's really useful. And explaining it in the context of things like exercise and musical instruments really helps it kind of bring it home for people. And I suppose this use it or lose it idea that again works with aerobic capacity or muscle mass and strength, right? Is,
yeah,
as you're saying,
it's exactly the same. Yeah,
the same for the brain. Yeah. So yeah, that's really useful and I think really encouraging as well. So turning now, and I appreciate there's infinitely more you could say about that, but turning now to like brain injuries. Traumatic brain injuries, concussions, that sort of thing. So you've been trying to protect your brain and, you know, you play a contact sport like I used to, you know, hence my lovely smashed up face. But so something's gone wrong, right? And you sustained a big hit to the head. How do we, so first off, I suppose, I thought it was really interesting that there isn't a formal set or agreed upon definition of concussion. So I suppose I was going to ask you, why you think that is, and this is a three-part question that you'll hate, but why you think that is, how you would define it, and then the second part is how you'd go about addressing that damage or mitigating the damage.
I'll answer your second question first, which is that I'm actually not sure how I would define it, if I'm honest, and which then leads me to answer your first question, that there's no agreed upon definition. So you will, you know, if people are physicians or athletes in contact sports, of course there are ways to look at how function has changed after a significant head impact or head injury. There are ways to determine whether somebody is thought to be fit to return to play, right? These definitions of course exist and they're very important. The problem is that we don't really know what kind of impact or where is enough to disturb function or is going to disturb the health, for want of a better word, of the brain in a way that isn't detectable currently but could still have implications long term. And that's really where the issues arise. We're now starting to appreciate things like CTE, chronic traumatic encephalopathy. This is something that you actually can't diagnose formally until you have that person's brain sliced up and under a microscope after they've passed away.
It's a bit later. Yeah.
So and it's, by that point, you're right. It's a bit late. Some people will talk about, defining concussion based on any loss of function. Then it's a question of, well, what functions are you measuring? There are things like an impact score, which they do a lot in youth and adolescent athletics in the US. So you have some kind of baseline cognitive function testing, and then you see how it's an impact affects it. And then you see like whether they return to baseline before they improve again. But there may be more subtle changes that aren't being measured.
And is that, so this sounds like it might be a bit of an inane question, but is that their own personal baseline, or is this a sort of standardized, empirically derived baseline?
No, it should be their personal baseline, right? Everybody's brain is good at different things, and you need to know what their baseline is. So places, institutions, athletic leagues that use this, they will have a baseline score. They'll see how it's affected by an impact, and then they'll try and make sure that somebody's back to baseline before they can play again. There are also some more sensitive technologies maybe that are coming in. So there's things like using basic EEG metrics. So you measure the electrical activity in the brain, and you see how you respond to like a light stimulus or a noise stimulus. And again, you can compare that to a baseline. So essentially, if there's any detectable disturbance in function, I think that should be the definition of a concussion. But I acknowledge that I work with some people who say that if any cell in the brain is irreparably damaged, even one, that should be the definition of a concussion. But we can't measure that at the level of a single cell. We just can't measure that change. So that's where some of this gray area starts to exist.
And presumably, if it's a very low threshold like that, I mean, presumably we would all get sort of traumatic brain injuries, or like how much? Do you see what I'm saying? Is it, say I bash my head, going up the stairs or something? Is that okay?
And that might be how much does that matter? Did you irreparably damage at least one cell in your brain? We just don't know. So I work with a really great neurosurgeon on a couple of projects that we have in the lab. And like when I first met him, he said, "Have you ever had a concussion?" And I said, "No." And he said, "Well, how do you know?" Right? Because by his definition of a concussion, I could have had several and would never know about it. So that's where this gray area exists. It's like, what amount of change in the brain is enough for us to call it a concussion? And the answer is we don't really know.
Assuming, right, that I understand. Yeah. So assuming we have had some sort of, you've had a major shot to the head. You've had something, bad, like a car crash, or you've had, you've lost consciousness, right? You've really hit your head. And again, I'm not a medical doctor, but like something, that even I would know, probably need to get a hospital, right? Probably need to get that checked out. So say that's happened. Are there any, you hear about, oxygen therapy, you hear about ketosis, you hear about creatine, you hear about any number of things that you can tell me about. What are the most sort of important things to do? And what would you do? So if that happened to you or your mom or your wife or whatever, what would you advise them?
So can I go before, I'm going to go before the impact occurs, and I'm going to assume that, say we're in a scenario where we have some control over the individual first, and they're in a situation, or they put themselves in situations where there are a high likelihood of having a concussion. So say they're a contact sport athlete. There are a few things that I would think about first. So the most important thing, as much as you can improve it, is the physical health of that athlete. And it might sound silly when I say that, but when you look at elite level football players, American football players here in the US, when you look at very high level rugby players, even Olympic level judo players and other contact sport players that may go to the Olympics, there are several studies that show, particularly the bigger athletes, right? Prop forwards, heavyweight judo players, these individuals aren't necessarily in great metabolic health. They have a lot of the components of metabolic syndrome. So they're pre-diabetic, they have lipid issues, liver function issues. And we know that particularly blood sugar regulation is critical to maximize the likelihood of a good outcome after any kind of brain injury. And we're talking strokes, traumatic brain injury, a range of other brain injuries. So doing whatever you can to improve the health of that individual. And so measuring, HbA1c, lipids, all the sort of, even just like the basics, metabolic health, that's really important, and improving that as much as possible. Then I might think about what supplements or nutritional components might be important. So I previously mentioned things like omega-3s, B vitamins. So you can measure homocysteine, and homocysteine is critically important for again response to many kinds of brain injuries, and that's usually a marker of folate and B12 status. Sometimes B6 and B2, which is riboflavin. So that's important. We know that vitamin D is really important. We know that iron status is important. So just like getting nutrition really dialed in. There are some studies that suggest that over the course of a season in American football, if you supplement with just a small amount of omega-3s, you can decrease a peripheral circulating biomarker of brain injury. So, you know, getting that stuff sorted is important. Then if I were a contact athlete, I would take creatine. There are also studies that suggest, again, from American football, that creatine can become depleted in the brain from impacts, even minor impacts. And there's now a thought that if you deplete creatine in the brain, you sort of decrease the energetic buffer in the brain and you increase susceptibility to future impacts. So creatine is something I would take. Choline seems to be very similar in this regard. That's something else I would consider. And then, you know, there are other nutrients that could be important, particularly for sleep and recovery, like making sure you're getting enough magnesium, that kind of stuff, probably worth thinking about as well. So that kind of puts you in as good a state as possible before a head injury occurs. And I don't have large randomized controlled trials for all of these things, but they're all super low risk. There's definitely evidence in humans that you may get benefit. And you know, that's how I would minimize risk as much as possible.
And as you said, they'll help for all sorts of general cognitive health and performance, yeah. Right? Omega-3s, creatine, they'll help for people who are concerned about dementia, et cetera,
yeah.
as well. Right?
Yeah, it's the same nutrients, you know, across all of these, you know, areas, because I think they're just sort of like fundamentally important for brain function. Immediately after the impact, again, I don't have great evidence for this. It doesn't exist yet. These trials are being done. I would put myself in a state of ketosis with exogenous ketones and probably moving to at least a low carbohydrate diet. That's not something that I could recommend to all the athletes I work with, because again, the level of evidence isn't great, but it's what I would do personally. One thing that I do think we could recommend to everybody is to make sure we control blood sugar as well as possible. I already mentioned why blood sugar is really important, but you know, you can imagine, you know, you're on a rugby pitch, you take a big knock, and then as you're carried off the pitch, somebody puts like a Powerade or, you know, Lucozade bottle in your hand and you start like drinking, right? Don't do that. I would, you know, keep blood sugar as regulated and stable as possible. So very unrefined carbohydrate sources, you know, and then make sure that, you know, lots of fiber, lean, you know, protein, that kind of stuff. I would focus on that. Something that I've studied a lot in my career in relation to brain injury is temperature regulation. So there's a big move currently in a number of sports, including international rugby, to actively cool down the individual and their brain after an impact. This has been done in dozens, if not more, trials costing billions at this point, and an active cooling, unfortunately, does not really work for any brain injury except for neonatal hypoxic ischemic encephalopathy in term newborn babies. So when people are saying you have to cool, you know, put on these cooling caps and all this kind of stuff, there really isn't much evidence yet. And they're right. International rugby is using them. They're at the last World Cup, a bunch of the teams had it. There isn't great evidence for that. And the people who make these products have run pretty terrible studies that have been used to support this. However, with that said, there are a couple of important aspects. One is that sport often happens in a heat stressed environment. So if you can do anything to bring core temperature down, right? And so the idea is to make sure that somebody is not feverish. So you just want to make sure they don't develop a fever. So in some sports, I might have athletes get in an ice bath beforehand, right? So we know that they're not starting already overheated at the time of an impact. And then afterwards, do whatever you can to make sure they don't get a fever. So if you have to use paracetamol, or other things, or you find other ways to cool them down. It's really avoiding the fever that's critical. And you get a fever in the first few hours after an injury as part of a normal immune response. So I don't think active cooling has very good evidence, as in to try and make core temperature hypothermic. There isn't much evidence for that, but preventing a fever, and particularly in the peripheral body, because that heats up the blood that goes up through the carotid arteries into the head, right? That's why external head cooling doesn't make any sense, because you're still sending hot blood up into the brain.
From the rest of the body, yeah.
From the rest of the body, exactly. So there's some of the idea is correct, just the execution isn't great. But temperature regulation is really important.
You actually would say you do want to, because I've heard, so you do want to minimize that inflammation. So in this context, obviously in some contexts, some inflammation, people, I've interviewed people where they've talked about ice not perhaps being the best thing after an injury. But in this specific context relating to the brain, there is, you don't want to let these sort of inflammatory processes happen. You do want to limit them.
So some inflammation, again, is part of healing. So that's normal here too. You don't want to get rid of it entirely. The main thing is temperature itself. And the reason for that is as temperature increases, you increase metabolic demand. And in a brain injury, you have decreased energy production capacity because you've injured those cells. And then if you heat up those cells, you create a bigger gap between demand and supply. And then that triggers a whole bunch of downstream things that can later result in cell death and those other kinds of things. So the main thing is avoiding a fever as much as you can.
Okay. And this is in the sort of relatively short term.
Yeah. Like
aftermath
days,
of the injury.
Yeah. Hours to days.
How long? Okay. Hours to days we're talking. Yeah. So after sort of a couple of weeks, this would be less effective, I'm assuming.
Yeah. No. So I'm mainly thinking about the first sort of 72 hours.
72 hours. Okay.
That's critical.
That's really useful to know. And is there anything? So, I mean, this is a selfish question, but I've had quite a few concussions. Is there anything you can do way after the fact? Like, I mean, not necessarily way up, but like significantly after, you know, that might have that might make a difference. In addition to all the things you've already mentioned, that, you know, metabolic health, omega-3s, creatine, you know, B vitamin status, vitamin D, all that stuff.
Yeah. So in the sort of what we might call the subacute phase. So say you've rode out. So those first 3 days, the most important things that you can do are regulate blood sugar, make sure you get enough sleep, and regulate temperature. I think that's really that window, really important. Then, in terms of promoting recovery, light physical activity as soon as you can seems to be really, really good for promoting recovery. So in most of the studies have been done in like adolescent concussions, but there are some randomized controlled trials where they do things like they figure out how intense the exercise has to be for it to cause symptoms. So say you go for a jog, how fast do you run before you start to get any kind of symptoms related to the injury? You then go just below that threshold. And you do that for like 30 minutes, 3 times a week or something like that. So it's probably going to be getting on a bike or a brisk walk or something like that. Some light aerobic exercise regularly, you know, sort of in the weeks, you know, days and weeks then after the injury. If there's some overlap between when you want to start exercising and that sort of temperature period, then I've definitely had athletes wear like ice vests and stuff so they don't get too hot while they're exercising. So that's, you know, it would just depend on the scenario, but that's a possibility. Then sort of long term and or longer term, and this is something that we're actually a student of mine is writing a paper on, there are some like physiotherapy and other interventions that you could do that are maybe going to be based on the specific symptoms. So physical activity seems to be one of the best ones. But so say if you have some balance issues, then there's things like vestibular rehab that can be really, really helpful kind of specifically for those targeted symptoms. More broadly, so if you have like brain fog or fatigue, this is where I think things like hyperbaric oxygen therapy may come into play. I would not do them immediately after the injury. I would probably wait at least a couple of weeks because there is some evidence that again, like I mentioned, increasing temperature can increase metabolic rate and metabolic demands. Hyperbaric oxygen can do that same thing. So you may make the injury worse if you apply it right after the injury. And again, I don't have great evidence, but there's enough for me to say I would just avoid that because I'm concerned based on the evidence that does exist. When you get into the more prolonged period, again, you know, these studies are still being done, but then there's maybe some evidence that hyperbaric oxygen can help support recovery. The studies that exist haven't been particularly good. So it's not like something I say everybody should do. But if you get to the point where, you know, you're several months out from a significant head injury, you're still experiencing significant symptoms, you've thought about everything else I've mentioned, then, you know, maybe that's something that's worth considering.
That's a pretty comprehensive way of addressing things. So I suppose a couple of questions following on from this, which I just love your appreciate this is you speculating, but I'd love to sort of get your qualified opinion on these sorts of things. How would you feel? I think I'm correct in saying that you don't have any children, but if you were to have kids, you know, how would you feel about them playing rugby or American football or ice hockey or, you know, perhaps wrestling or some of those sports where they're gonna have, to a greater or lesser extent, some kind of head trauma?
Yeah, it's a really tricky question. It's more of a fraught question, if I'm honest, over here in the US, where there's a much higher social status attached to specific sports, even in children, than there is in the UK. I've done some sports medicine, or I've been exposed to some sports medicine here in the US, where parents are asking their children to do stuff that is really not in their best interest because of the social status based on the sport. And I think, like, everything about that is bad, as far as I can tell. I think there are some good initiatives to try and at least decrease the likelihood of significant head impacts in children, like no heading the ball in football, or, you know, what we call football, and then a soccer, and then in American football, you know, playing things like flag football or non-tackle football, at least until a certain age. All of those things I'd encourage. There are some things that you can do, and there have been some initiatives, like in American football, where they try and teach the athletes how to tackle properly, like, and actually a more of a rugby style tackle rather than just like bashing into somebody
head first.
Head first. And so this is one of the issues I have with some types of protective equipment, is they give the illusion of safety. So a helmet or a scrum cap, people think that might protect the head in the case of an impact. It might protect you from cracking your skull, but it's actually doing very little at the level of the brain. But you might think you're protected, so then you put your brain in more precarious situations because you think you have some level of protection. So I think just educating people or children about, you know, just because you're wearing a helmet doesn't mean that your brain is protected. And, you know, you still have to take that into account. I think that's important. So, like, not generating the illusion of safety, which could actually make things worse. And then, you know, if, you know, kids should play sports and they should play a range of sports, I think that's beneficial too. There's a lot of evidence for sampling lots of different sports-related skills. If you just want a generally well-balanced kid who's got a brain that's received a wide range of inputs, that's great. So generally, as you get to the higher level of a sport, that's where, you know, often the tackles get harder, the likelihood of a concussion may increase even further. So just think about balancing, you know, the range of different sports and maybe not focusing everything on rugby, but then, you know, also there's some tennis or badminton or, you know, something else like that. And then, you know, do whatever you can to make sure that your kid is eating a nutritious diet, including all those things that I mentioned earlier, right? That's going to give some element of protection. That's kind of how I would approach all of that. I think kids should play sport. All of the sports I mentioned are sports that I enjoy either playing or watching. So I certainly wouldn't want to discourage people, but just, you know, keeping all of that stuff in mind is important.
And I'm going to keep this question deliberately vague because I don't want you to sort of answer or say anything that you don't want to. But do you have any views particularly on you probably saw it in the US with the sort of concussion litigation type stuff. You've doubtless seen, you might even be an expert in it. I don't know. The litigation, I'm asking with my lawyer's hat on, the concussion litigation from a lot of ex-rugby players, notably people will remember Steve Thompson from the 2003 World Cup winning rugby team, the hooker, and he's got all sorts of, as I understand it, issues essentially stemming from his rugby career. I don't want you to say anything I'm just wondering if you have any views. I'll keep it as vague as possible. Comment, don't comment. I can move on. Up to you.
Yeah. I think there's two parts to this. One is that if you, as any kind of formalized body or funding body, have made money off somebody else's body and they end up with significant injuries as a result, they should be fairly compensated for it. I think that's reasonable, right?
Yeah.
In the NFL, previously, the way they assessed the effect of, the possible effect of these repeated head injuries on cognitive function was different based on the individual's race. I think that is a bad idea, it was essentially inherently pretty racist. That's been overturned now, and I think they're no longer doing that. So I think that's good. One thing I will say is that this is tricky because, like, we've already talked about how even now in 2024 we can't define a concussion. So when you go to the beginning of Steve Thompson's career, we just didn't really know that much about it. So it's also difficult to find somebody culpable if that knowledge didn't exist at the time. There's a tricky balance between what could you reasonably have expected to have been told about protected from at a given period of time based on the knowledge at the time versus making sure that somebody is adequately supported and compensated for the injuries they've received. I appreciate that's a tricky balance. And that's going to be part of the conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. And as you said, the lack of knowledge, and especially the lack of knowledge going back, for him, it's going back 30 years, perhaps. That has all sorts of issues for consent, right? If it's not informed because you don't have the knowledge, right? So I think that's certainly...
I will say that at least in some sports, there is certainly evidence that they just didn't ask the questions because they didn't want to know the answer. So some of it was potentially purposeful ignorance, and that, again, can't really be condoned. So all of the... I don't have a particular answer. I think people should be compensated if they've received significant injuries and somebody else has made money off that, particularly. But all of this is like, what do we know? What do we think we might have known, but actively didn't want to know, right? All of this stuff is important.
And it's, as you said, it's also all very well applying 2024 science to 2004 or whatever it might be. Nobody has a crystal ball, right? Or didn't back then, you know what I mean? Not that they do today. Sorry, that was a convoluted way of explaining it. But so turning again, and I suppose continuing with this sort of cognitive enhancement theme or the cognitive theme, I've given away the question there. Cognitive enhancement. So this is my sort of specialist area. I did my PhD in enhancement, doping in sport, all this sort of stuff. So enhancement is very much my special area. I was wondering, obviously, things like omega-3s, creatine, caffeine, theanine, there are all sorts of things that can help you perform, in an interview or in an exam or whatever it might be. But I was wondering how you, and this is going to sort of segue onto your personal sort of habits and routines. I sound a bit like Tim Ferriss there, but how you would go about preparing for, how did you, obviously you already had a doctoral qualification, but how did you go about preparing for your PhD, Viva? How would you go about preparing for, something you give evidence to Parliament or Congress or whatever it might be? How would you go about being as sharp as you can sort of cognitively be?
The most important thing to do is get adequate sleep. I think that's like number one, two, and three, probably. And then, because you hope that up to that point, you've done whatever preparation is necessary, right? And then you're just trying to execute on the preparation that you've already done. So then sleep is going to be critical. And actually, I did not do this well for my PhD because I was living in the US by the time that I defended. Then I went back to Norway to defend my PhD. So I was jet lagged, stressed, sleep deprived. So I didn't do a good job there. But if I had had the opportunity to do it again or do it better, you know, I would have maybe flown over a few days earlier, had the chance to sort of relax. And but, you know, I got my PhD, so that was fine. Then there are lots of potentially interesting supplements. Like that's where a lot of the questions come from. And I think that, again, that like baseline health and nutritional status is great. I routinely take creatine. I take it every day. I also take omega-3s if I'm not eating a lot of fish regularly, and that kind of waxes and wanes. So I just sort of fill that gap depending on how much I'm eating. I also, I make sure I get enough magnesium in particular. I take it before bed just because to get a good amount of magnesium from the diet regularly can be tricky. So I fill that gap. I also, you know, B vitamins, all that kind of stuff. I have those bases covered. So I think that, again, it is important. Then it depends largely on what it is that you want to perform at. So one of the things that I work with, or particularly say in athletes, I do some work in Formula One, and I largely work with the Formula One coaches who are like the person who are with the driver all day, every day, run every part of their training, you know, sleep, nutrition, all that kind of stuff. And I sort of support them to do that job. And if you're trying to perform at, say, a Formula One race, and I'll use it for a specific example, there is a trade-off between different parts of cognitive function. So I'm sure you're very aware of the Yerkes-Dodson arousal curve, right?
I talk about it every day, yeah, all the time, yeah.
So the fundamental idea being that for complex cognitive functions, there's an inverted U-shaped curve or a bell-shaped curve, right? Where on the X-axis, you have a level of arousal, and on the Y-axis, you have level of performance. So for a given task, there is an optimal level of arousal.
And so there is a sweet spot, yeah.
There is a sweet spot, and right, so you can imagine that if you're a 100-meter sprinter in the Olympics, your bell curve is shifted way up to the right, right? You need to be really aroused because reaction time off the line is like some massive amount of your performance. Whereas if you're an Olympic archer, right, your bell curve is all the way down the other end. You want to be really relaxed, you know, really steady. This is why they used to take beta blockers or drink alcohol, why you can't use those in those sports, because they're depressants. So there's an optimal point. And some people, right, you come into a race and maybe you're really stressed and really anxious, you know, even if this is your profession, but you get very anxious around a performance. So then you need to find ways to decrease arousal. So I'm not giving that person caffeine, right, because you're just going to push them in the other direction. Whereas other people are just like super chill and you need to find a way to amp them up. And then some, you know, stimulating supplements may be beneficial. And there's also a trade-off because, and we've seen this actually in a few drivers, which is that if you amp somebody up, they'll be faster off the line. You can increase psychomotor vigilance. You can increase reaction time. But as you do that, and this is also based on that classic like Yerkes and Dodson work, you can overstimulate them and then they become less good at the complex tasks of driving a Formula One car, which include navigating corners, figuring out what else is going on, listening to the pit wall, right? It's a much more complex task. So you can be really good at the simple task, which is reaction time off the line, but you can actually decrease your ability to do these other more complex tasks. So that's just a long way of saying that it really depends on the task that you're trying to do and whether you need to increase or decrease your arousal in order to perform best at it. So if you're going to increase arousal, then things like caffeine, maybe creatine, tyrosine, taurine, some of these things can be useful, particularly if you're sleep deprived or stressed. They can help support cognitive function. But if you're already somebody who's very anxious, then maybe you need to do some breath work or meditation or something else to try and decrease arousal in order to perform optimally. So like it's just going to depend on the person and the scenario they're trying to perform in.
That's so interesting as well. Yeah. So one person's enhancement is another person's hindrance. And
exactly.
As you said, depends. What would help you in boxing would not help you in darts or whatever it might be to you. Sort of, yeah, that lends a rationale to sort of sport-specific anti-doping policies and that sort of thing then.
Yeah, exactly. Right. You don't care if a 100-meter sprinter takes a beta blocker because it's not going to make him any faster. No. But exactly.
That's really interesting. We've covered a lot there. And I think maybe one of the last things on brain health specifically as it relates to sort of decline and injury, I suppose, is this relationship between, you know, the hereditary factors and dementia and Alzheimer's and various things like that. I was wondering if you could... So some people will be very concerned if they have certain genetic variants, for example, that might... in my sort of layman's understanding, that might predispose them perhaps slightly more to cognitive decline, you know, in whatever form that might come. So I was wondering if you could sort of explain a little bit about that. And I think how you started was really encouraging in that there's a lot within your control and it's not all sort of predetermined. So I don't want to lead you on any of this sort of stuff, but how concerned should people be? And again, you know, how would you sort of think about these things and advise them? Because obviously people need to remember that as well as a researcher, you're a doctor or you're a physician as well, right? So I think you're very well qualified to comment on these things.
I will say that I don't currently practice clinically because I don't have a US medical license. But yes, I am medically trained and I have worked.
But you have practiced.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So this is a great question. It's an important question. And probably the first place to start is by saying that, so we're thinking particularly about Alzheimer's, dementia, Alzheimer's disease. There are two broad types. There is one type called early onset Alzheimer's disease, which is very largely genetic. It's caused by usually one mutation in one gene, like a presenilin gene or the amyloid precursor protein gene. And this causes early onset. It's in the name, like in your 30s, 40s, maybe 50s, and fairly...
Yeah.
Consistent really decline in cognitive function. Yeah. So it really is early. That is genetic, and that's maybe 1% of Alzheimer's disease cases. So it's not relevant to the vast majority of people. The vast majority of people experience late onset or sporadic or Alzheimer's disease. I call it age-related dementia. And this does have a genetic component, but the vast majority of it is driven by lifestyle and the environment and other health-related factors. So genetics seems to contribute somewhere between 5 and 10% of your overall risk. Having any individual genetic aspect is not a guarantee that you will get the disease, and not having it is also not a guarantee. So the most well-known one, and probably the single biggest genetic risk factor in modern westernized populations, is ApoE4. So the ApoE gene, there are three different types, ApoE2, 3, and 4. If you have one copy of ApoE4, and you have two copies of ApoE, so you can have a combination of any of those numbers. If you have one copy of ApoE4, that increases your risk of Alzheimer's disease by maybe like 2 to 8 or 10 times. If you have two copies, it's more like 6 to 20 times. But you see, like, there's a big range there. Your ApoE genotype contributes about 5% of your overall risk. So 95% is not related to that. So the vast majority is not related to that. There are at least three populations and studies from three different populations, which in my mind tell us that it's still the environment that drives whether ApoE4 is important for disease risk. So most of the studies that show that ApoE4 is associated with increased risk are in the US. In general, they tend to be white people, you know, on average, you know, majority white in a westernized population. When you look at indigenous Americans in the US, when you look at the Bolivian Chimene, when you look at the Nigerian Yoruba, living in an environment that's closer to what their ancestors evolved in, ApoE4 does not increase risk of cognitive decline or dementia. So there are gene times our environment interactions that seem to be important here. So I would say that I don't think ApoE4 has to be a risk factor if you take care of all the other important environmental factors that we've already talked about. That, again, I don't have amazing randomized controlled trial evidence, but I just think the epidemiological evidence kind of suggests that, at least. And the fact that the total contribution to your risk is relatively small. It's a few percent. So then, you know, people will often think or ask, and I've often been asked this question, my mum got Alzheimer's disease, or my dad, or my family members, you know, am I going to get it? And so, yes, there's a genetic component there, and it's more complex than ApoE, but, you know, there is a genetic component. But if things are continuing in families, it's probably more a shared environment and shared lifestyles that are a bigger driver of risk than shared genetics. The shared genetics do play a role, but, you know, if you're eating the same way, living the same way as relatives who developed Alzheimer's disease, that's probably where the biggest risk or biggest common risk is going to come from.
So that's a sort of good news, bad news scenario. Bad news in that if you sort of perpetuate this cycle, it's probably not ideal, not very good for you. But good news in that, A, it's within your control, and B, you know, it's not all predetermined. So there's so much you can do. So, I mean, as someone with a family history of Alzheimer's, that's very encouraging stuff. So is there anything sort of more specific in addition to all the things that you've mentioned, which have been a lot, that you should sort of watch out for or any kind of, you know, are there any sort of further bits of advice you give or we pretty much, you pretty much covered it?
There's not too much to add. I think one thing that's worth mentioning is that now several studies have suggested that somewhere between 40 and 70 something percent of all dementia are preventable. And a good chunk of that due to health related factors and the environment. Something that I didn't mention earlier, but which is a significant risk factor, but is related to this idea of challenging our brains, is the loss of senses. So if we lose sensory inputs, where we develop cataracts or we develop hearing loss, then that's associated with an increased risk of dementia. And I think about it because you're not using a part of your brain anymore because you're no longer getting that input. So that's how it fits in those buckets that I mentioned earlier, at least in my mind. And particularly in those who are at high risk of dementia, it seems that risk is reversible if you then restore the sense. So you get cataract surgery or you get hearing aids. So if you or a loved one is starting to, you know, need something like that, needs hearing aids, and some people like struggle on because, you know, they feel like they're getting old. They don't want to get hearing aids because that makes them feel old. Get those hearing aids because that is actually going to improve your or decrease your risk of dementia. Then another thing, and also related to that, is something that is worth acknowledging, is that societal factors are really important here. So one of the most protective factors against later dementia and related to the maximum point of cognitive function, which then determines how long it might be until you experience dementia, right? Because the higher the peak, if you have about the rate same of decline on average, you'll end up at dementia later in life, is how much education you got early in life. And so education is an incredibly protective factor for dementia risk, but not everybody has the same opportunity to get the same amount of education. So there are these societal level factors that need to be improved from a top-down approach. So education is one, but then also, other socioeconomic factors, either related to socioeconomic status, you know, how people have access to healthcare and that kind of stuff. Those things are important for dementia risk as well. So if we want to minimize dementia risk at a population level, we need to change some of those things in addition to these sort of like individual lifestyle factors.
Yeah, that's very interesting. And it's very interesting highlighting the difference between, as you said, population level sort of aggregate stuff and specific individual instances. Okay, there's a lot to take in there, but that's really useful. And I mean, so it's education early on. So what if you were to sort of, I don't know, I taught someone who was doing an undergraduate degree in their 70s, for example.
Great.
Would that Okay.
That's fantastic. What a perfect example of late life, or like challenging your brain in late life. So yeah, most formal education is like continuous from early in life, right? So that's what I did. I went up into secondary school, then I did my undergraduate degree, then I did my medical degree, then I did my PhD, right? But it doesn't have to be like that. Absolutely. Some people come to education later in life, you know, as a second career. All of that is great. So the time doesn't matter. It's just think about like the total amount of time in your entire life where you are sort of challenging your brain in that way.
That makes a lot of sense. An MD, PhD, you're probably good until about 200 then, right?
If that, yeah, with that. I was a student until basically my mid-30s.
Well, in fairness, so was I. I had a break, but so was almost, so was, yeah. I. So, you know, I'm not going to throw any stones from my glass house there. So turning to kind of a perhaps less, turning to a more sort of lifestyle and talking about what you do personally, a lot of people are going to say, okay, so, you know, Dr. Tommy's recommending these things and it makes a lot of sense. I'm sure he's got a lot of empirical evidence and observation, et cetera. But what do you sort of personally do? I know that you have a very interesting background. You were a rower, and then you've competed in all sorts of sports, from ultra marathons to CrossFit to now a sport that I really like, and I've competed in strongman.
Uh-huh.
So I was wondering, and I know that you've done a podcast on this where you sort of detail your daily routines and all that sort of thing, but I was wondering if you could give us just a very quick overview of, I suppose, a day in the life, which would take into account, you know, all the sorts of ways in which you sleep and eat and train and work that, you know, help you, A, because a lot of people would be interested, A, sort of operate at this very high level in several walks of life, and B, you know, that you think is going to stand you in good stead, albeit the fact that most people don't have, you know, lots of postgraduate degrees to sort of start from.
Yeah, sure. So I like to think that the most of the things I talk about, I do walk the talk, and that's important to me. So I guess I'll start with sleep, because I think that's just like this really critical foundation. And also, like, different people need different amounts of sleep and perform well or less well under sleep deprivation. I am not somebody who performs well in chronic sleep deprivation, and that has been well documented by several people who know me well. So I think about preparing for sleep by working back from when I'm going to wake up. So we have two dogs. The dogs wake up at 6 a.m. And I get up and I feed them and adore. That's when my day starts. So regardless of what else happens, whenever we go to bed, the dogs are going to get up at 6. So if I want to get 9 hours in bed, which is I like to try and get 9 hours of sleep opportunity, and that in that period, I'm probably going to hopefully get 7 to 8 hours of actual sleep. So then I need to be in bed at 9. I and some other people, although again, it's context dependent, I sleep better if I haven't eaten immediately before bed. So I usually try and have dinner ready around 6, between 6 and 7. That's when we eat dinner. And then after that, sometimes I have deadlines and stuff that have to be done. You know, I'm about to go on holiday, so I've got a whole bunch of stuff I'm trying to clear off my desk. So last night, I worked later after dinner, but I try not to work after dinner. And, you know, either, you know, reading, or, you know, we generally watch some TV or something, you know, start to turn the lights down, just start to sort of like this slow sort of relaxation towards bedtime. I like wearing blue light blocking glasses in the hour or so before bed. There's some evidence for it, but also at this point it's almost Pavlovian. Like the glasses go on and I know it's time for bed.
Yeah,
so it's kind of like
routine,
preparing.
Right?
Yeah, it's part of this routine. My wife likes sort of like a herbal tea before bed, right? So that's often part of the routine. Maybe she also likes a hot bath before bed. That helps her sleep, and that's got some good evidence before it. So we have these kind of routines that set us up for bed, sort of starting like kind of around dinner time and then winding down from there. I'll then jump forward to the morning, but in the morning, I like caffeine. I like coffee. And so my morning routine includes letting the dogs out, feeding them breakfast and then making myself a cup of coffee. I like sort of getting the caffeine in early. There's been discussions just about like waiting a certain amount of time after you wake up to have the cup of coffee.
That was what I was going to ask you about. Is there, you know, how much do you worry about waiting an hour and a half before you have your caffeine or anything
I don't worry about that at all. And I've never noticed it to make any difference when that's just happened. Some people think it helps them. If you think it helps you, regardless of whether it does actually help you, if you think it helps you, it's probably going to help you. So that's great. Whenever you want to have your cup of coffee, have it then. Fine. I do try and stop caffeinated beverages by about midday. Because I don't sleep as well if I have caffeine after about sort of 11, 12 o'clock. So I just know that. And that's probably the case for most people, as well. And often people get in this cycle where, you know, to help themselves wind down at the end of the day, they drink alcohol. Then the next morning, they need to consume more caffeine because they didn't sleep well because they drank. So like, if that sounds like you, maybe think about how ways that you can improve that so you can sort of like get out of that cycle.
If you do have to deal with, you know, as a practicing physician, you would have dealt with some sleep deprivation, I'm assuming, especially working in the NHS, etc.
Yeah.
Are there any things you do that if you have had a bad night's sleep, right? Because you hear about high intensity exercise, restoring insulin sensitivity, you hear about non-sleep deep rest, caffeine naps and stuff. Are there any sort of strategies that you use or any comments you'd have on or things like that?
So all of that can be great. I mentioned some supplements earlier that particularly in stressful situations and in the setting of sleep deprivation can be beneficial. Naps are great if you can get them. There's some nice studies on the improved cognitive function after naps, or you can be awake for, you know, several days in a row if you can occasionally get, you know, a nap in there and still perform okay, and with some caffeine potentially on top of that. Exercise is fantastic for boosting focus and cognitive function. It shouldn't be exhaustive exercise. Like if you like really crush yourself, that can actually have a negative effect on cognitive function. But, you know, something aerobic, lifting some weight, something like that is great. There's maybe a little bit of evidence that you can perform just as well if you're sleep deprived and taking creatine and or caffeine. Particularly, creatine may decrease total sleep need, but still allow you to perform cognitively. So all of these things can be great if you have time to do it. The most important thing I think probably is not to worry about it. And there are some very nice studies that show that if you're concerned, like if you think you slept poorly, even if you slept well, you'll actually perform cognitively worse. So you sort of, you create this idea that, oh, I'm going to perform terribly today because I didn't sleep very well. So trying to avoid that kind of negative expectation, it's hard to do sometimes. Don't get me wrong, but generally, so imagine you do all these things normally, right? You sleep well, you exercise, you eat well. You're in good overall physical health. You can tolerate a night of sleep deprivation just fine. You'll be fine, right? So, and I think that's the most important thing to remember. Of course, right? Imagine you're doing swing shifts and chronically sleep deprived. Yeah, of course, we know that has an impact on your health. But the occasional loss of a night of sleep, you're going to be fine. You've already built up a system that should be resilient. And one thing that I get concerned about is this sort of pursuit of continued optimization, where you then create a scenario where when things aren't optimal, you will actually perform worse because you're like, well, I didn't get all the things that I needed and now I'm not going to perform well. So
I think that's so important as well. Yeah. I mean, I've fallen into that trap so many times, but it needn't be a sort of self-fulfilling prophecy, negative self-fulfilling sort of cycle. Because as you said, you will, I don't know, fly across the Atlantic or have, there are tons of things that are going to sleep deprive you. You've spoken about this, and this was actually my next question, but performing under suboptimal conditions, which again, you know, Formula One, if they're traveling across the world, athletes, especially in the US, you know, like if you're the East Coast teams playing on the West Coast and vice versa and all that sort of stuff, 3 hours and like how do you, aside from not worrying about it, and I think you mentioned a clock manipulation study once that sort of it's you really, that sort of perception is reality in certain circumstances. What is there anything else? You know, how else would you approach it?
Yeah, I think just the overall mindset is what's really critical. And don't get me wrong, like I get that I fall foul of this as well sometimes myself. Just because you know the theory doesn't mean that you can always just do it. But I think that, you know, all these behaviors that we talk about that are really important for supporting health, be it sleep or diet, physical activity, what they're doing is they're creating resilience and headroom in your physiological systems so that you are able to, like, rather than trying to optimize everything, I think we should be trying to build resilience to be able to perform in suboptimal conditions, because nothing is ever perfect. But if we expect it to be perfect and then it's not, we will create, right, what you think will then directly affect your physiology. So that's the most important thing, is just maybe switching how you're thinking about your behaviors such that, you know, I'm training like 6 days a week, right? That means that I know that I'm physically fit. If something was to go wrong, I was to get sick and I can't train, or, you know, I'm traveling and I can't train, right? I already have a good buffer in that system, and actually I don't really need to worry about it that much. It's going to be okay. So it's just thinking about how you've already set yourself up to be just fine, even when things go wrong. That's kind of how I would frame it.
So, and like the brain, the body's, as you said, resilient, robust, able to, and especially if you're getting it right 80% of the time or whatever, whatever percentage you want to put on it, you know.
Yeah. We often think, like I said about the brain in the beginning, we often, like, when we're talking about optimizing and all these kind of things, it creates this perception that the human body is frail, but it's not. It's incredibly resilient and adaptable. So if you just, you know, most of the time you're creating opportunities to perform even under suboptimal conditions, actually, do you know what? You're in really good shape and you'll be just fine.
And you mentioned, this is, again, really encouraging stuff. I think people, you know, that should really take from this interview that it's very encouraging. A lot is within your control. A lot of this stuff is not sort of, you know, predestined. You really can control a lot through attitude and through lifestyle and all these sorts of factors. And you mentioned, for example, that you've shifted, like when you train, for example, so you had periods where if you were a rowers tend to train super early in the morning, right?
Yeah.
And then you mentioned when, I think you said your wife was living in the States and you were, you know, training till 10 o'clock at night. And you sort of, that's the absolute 12 hours, 14, whatever hours, my math isn't very good, you know, different, but you're still able to perform at different ends of the day. And nothing is quite as, you know, we're talking about 1 or 2% differences here. I mean, it might not be literally 1 or 2%, but small differences rather than sort of the overall picture of it, I suppose.
Yeah, I think this is what's part of the issue with, you know, you now see these circadian clocks that say, you know what, you do this best at this time of day and this best at this time of day and this best at this time of day. And they've even started to do that for, say, student athletes and professional athletes. So here in the US, right, collegiate athletics is big business. And, you know, understandably, researchers are worried about the athletes getting enough sleep, particularly if they're traveling a lot, lots of time zones. But if you tell somebody you perform best at 3 PM, because that's when body temperature is highest, what they internalize is not that is the best time for me to perform. It's that they internalize that every other time is the worst time for me to perform, right? We tend to focus on the negative. So then when you have to perform a game, like, in the morning, you're like, well, this isn't my best time. Like, I'm not going to perform as well. And so this is where well-meaning strategies to optimize performance can have a negative effect. And it's the same thing in terms of performance-related genetics, which are mostly nonsense. But what we do is we put these things in the athlete's head that can negatively affect their performance. So I try to avoid as much of that as possible. And instead, we know that the best time for you to train is the time that you can regularly train, right? And then that's the time when you will start to perform the best. So if you're a boxer and your bout, your title bout is at 2 AM, right, which happens sometimes, then you should train to perform at 2 a.m, right? Because that's when you're going to perform, right? Regardless of what any paper says about the time of day when you're going to perform best. So, and you can change that, right? So there have been periods of time when I trained every morning at 6 o'clock, and that was the time that I did my best performances. And there have been times when it's the middle of the afternoon, like it is now, and there have been times when it's been late at night. So again, the human body is super adaptable, super resilient, and whatever routine you can build that helps support all these behaviors is great. And if you have to perform outside of that, you're going to be just fine.
Yeah, I think that that's so important to remember. And I think turning again sort of back to your particular practices, I think one of the things that you do that is very, you mentioned that a dog was a great biohack, but for example, you get up and you take your dogs out. So, you know, Andrew Huberman would be very happy that you're presumably getting some early morning sunlight there. You know, you're getting outside, for example. You're sticking with very regular, you know, regular cues, regular kind of sunlight timing, getting up at the same time, all this sort of stuff. I'd love to kind of hear about how you, the rest of your day and how that sort of pans out in terms of, so we covered something, I think we were talking before we started recording, but fasting is a big thing at the moment in the longevity sphere, or time-restricted eating, or what intermittent fast, whatever we're calling it, right? Eating for long periods, et cetera.
Yeah.
And how you do that and how exercise relates to things like these big buzzwords like autophagy and mitophagy, and how, because you obviously have a very strong understanding of the physiology. So similar to what you just talked about a little bit of knowledge potentially being a dangerous thing, you have a lot of knowledge. So armed with all this knowledge, how do you sort of set things up? Because obviously you have a very demanding job mentally, and then you do strongman, which is very demanding physically, I can assure anybody. How do you set things up? How do you eat? That sort of thing.
Yeah, so I generally eat, I have breakfast around 9 or 10 a.m., and that's more.
Yeah, you are getting like a sort of 14 hour. So if you finish eating, if you have dinner at like 6:30, you said 7 or whatever, you finished eating by 7. So you are having this sort of, is that about right?
Yeah.
Roughly.
Yeah, 4 to 40. Yeah. So I eat in like a 9 to 10 hour window, something like that. And it's less to do with time restricted eating, and it's more to do with my work day and what feels good for me. So in general, if people can, I recommend that they structure their workday based on their ultradian rhythms, right? Their personal flow of energy and focus and motivation, which is different for all of us, and it's different across different parts of the day. So I normally start work. So I get up at 6, do the dog stuff, have my coffee, do my Wordle, and then I generally start my workday at 7 a.m. And then between 7 and 10, or 7 and 9 or 10, that's when I feel my most focused and ability to do like my deeper bits of work. If I have to do some writing, you know, maybe it's meetings in that time, but like my focused work, my best time for focused work is around then. And then could maybe continue sort of before lunchtime as well. So I'll kind of do some bits of work, have breakfast, do some more deeper bits of work. And then I'll have lunch. And then after lunch, right, in the afternoon, I maybe, you know, that's my period where I feel best doing some less cognitive demanding tasks. So maybe I'm responding to emails, just kind of like knocking out simple bits of the to-do list. You know, some other meetings might, I try and put a lot of meetings in that window as well. Cause so then I can save my morning for some of the some more focused work. And then about 3 o'clock, I tend to try and knock it off. So I work, 7 to 3 most days. Then I go to the gym, 6 days a week. And the reason why I go to the gym at 3 is because then at 5, I start cooking dinner so I can eat dinner at 6. So that's kind of, right. So it all kind of ties together that way. And generally, I eat, probably what it was, a fairly high protein, certainly low refined carbohydrate, although not low carbohydrate or ketogenic diet. And I cook almost all of our food at home. My meals, like breakfasts and lunches, tend to be like leftovers from other things I've eaten. So very sort of protein, and, you know, veggie, eat a lot of fruit, focused. And so then my training, I do 2 days a week of some kind of like low level aerobic training, zone two, as the fancy people would call it nowadays. Back when I was a rower, we would call it UT2, just like low level aerobic training. And then 4 days a week, I'll lift. I usually have a deadlift focused day and then some kind of press focused day. So if I'm doing, I've got a competition coming up in May, there's a log event. So I start with a log, and then some accessory work, a lot of like tricep and shoulder stuff to kind of support that. And then there's usually like a lower body focused day currently, again, because I'm getting close to a competition. So I'm working on sled drags and sandbag carries, and some more shoulder stuff on that kind of day, rather than like, whereas during the winter it might be like a squat day. And then there's another day that usually has some kind of anaerobic component, so I might do sprints on the rowing machine. Currently, again, because of events coming up, that's my yoke day, because it's a yoke event. So you know, it's sort of, the event is 90 seconds, how, you know, as far as possible with a yoke of a given weight. So I'll do some, you know, maybe like a minute. How far can I get the yoke? Then recover. But again, that's almost like doing a sprint on the rowing machine or on a treadmill or something. So it's kind of in that similar kind of capacity area. So that's kind of how my training is structured. And I really like it. It covers, you know, aerobic conditioning, we know is important. It covers strength. It covers, like, I think, yeah, some skill development, right? Lifting logs, carrying awkward objects, all that kind of stuff. I think that's a little bit more cognitively stimulating than, say, powerlifting. No offense to powerlifters. It's not my thing. So yeah, I like it, because I feel, even though I'm doing it with the mind of competing, I think there's a lot of transferable skills in terms of fitness, grip strength, awkward objects, you know, and a range of levels of fitness that kind of come with strongman training that I really like.
Yeah, you as you said, you're talking about these you hit so many different capacities with the strongman training, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And you said complemented with the sort of the low level, the you know, zone two training and that kind of thing. You're really hitting all the sort of key, you know, people will talk about losing fast twitch fibers and power. Well, you have plenty of that with strongman.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
You also will get more than people will realize, the aerobic and anaerobic capacity stuff with strongman, yeah. Right? Carrying a yoke for 60 or 90 seconds is pretty,
it's hard work.
Anybody who thinks, anybody thinks that won't be cardiovascularly demanding has never tried it, right?
Yeah, definitely. And I think it's also, you know, super accessible, right? Rocks of all sizes and shapes and weights exist, as do like things you can pick up. So I really like it. And then I guess to kind of come back to your question about fasting and exercise and that kind of stuff, there's an increasing body of evidence that I think really shows that the main benefit of fasting is the fact that you decrease caloric intake. For people who have been in a chronic caloric excess, which is very common, like most people are in that state, then decreasing caloric intake has a number of health related benefits. But whether you do it as fasting or you do it in terms of finding a way to decrease caloric intake, you know, at a lower level, and that can be counting calories, it could be changing the foods that you eat such that they are less calorie dense. All of that seems to work in the same way, and there really is nothing magic about fasting. If you look at, say, activation of autophagy, after, like, even let's say like a 24-hour fast, there isn't really any in humans at all. It probably is going to take three or more days of fasting to start to see an upregulation of these sort of cleaning processes where you start to clear out proteins and organelles and that kind of stuff. But you can upregulate those processes almost immediately with aerobic exercise. And that's been shown, like, just 30 minutes of aerobic exercise starts to activate autophagy. In humans, they've shown it in muscle tissue. But if you do aerobic exercise in rodents in a way that stimulates autophagy in muscle cells, you also start to see autophagy in other organs as well. So I think we could kind of suggest that maybe you'll see whole body autophagy benefits with just aerobic exercise. It happens faster in a shorter period of time. So So I know that you like the quote from Bill Lagarkos, which is that exercise is fasting and fast forward. And I think that's absolutely true. There's also a very nice meta-analysis that my friend Kristy Storoshuk just published, comparing responses to fasting in humans and rodents. And basically, you know, there are now these really prestigious papers from really prestigious professors that say, you know, fasting upregulates autophagy, mitochondrial biogenesis, like all these amazing things that happen. And they happen in mice, but they don't happen in humans. And this is now, I think, shown pretty clearly that fasts, even up to 3 days, don't activate mitochondrial biogenesis, don't particularly activate autophagy. And actually, you will instead activate those processes through exercise. So I don't think right now, I don't think there's any evidence to say there's anything magic about fasting. And I would much prefer you do exercise and eat, because I think there are a whole host of greater benefits from that that are very well supported by the literature, rather than worrying about not eating for any long period of time.
And as you said, people who are worried about longevity tend to be perhaps a little bit older, and then you have concerns about sarcopenia.
Absolutely.
And muscle is a glucose sink. You might actually be better off with, I hesitate to say maximizing muscle mass, because people will think of Ronnie Coleman, but yeah, within reason, you know, within reason for the average person, maximizing muscle mass, because that's going to have all sorts of, yeah.
Yeah. And you're right. So whatever you can do as you get older to at least maintain, if not gain, muscle mass is going to be incredibly important. And then resistance training is really the key there. And if you, so say you are, right, I didn't say that fasting was bad, right? And it's not bad. If fasting is something that works well for you, it's, you know, it allows you to then eat in a way that you enjoy eating, but then fasting helps support physical health or mental health or, you know, anything like that, great. You should do it. Absolutely. But if you're going to fast for extended periods of time, you should do resistance training during that fast, because that will help you preserve muscle mass while you're fasting.
During the fast, you should. Idea that you're going to break down muscle tissue and not be able to repair it and then lose even more muscle is not necessarily in significant
caloric deficits, of which fasting is the most extreme end, resistance training absolutely preserves muscle mass. So if you're going to fast for extended periods, definitely. It doesn't need to be like your max set, like all out training. You just have to put some stimulus on those muscles in order to preserve them during the fast.
Again, we go back to the use it or lose it scenario.
It's the same. It's always the same. Yeah.
There's a theme there, isn't there? Yeah. Okay. So this is super useful. I guess a couple of final questions. So on the longevity side of things, we've heard a lot in the last couple of years. I know there's actually been an FDA ruling recently on it, but about these longevity supplements. So things like NMN, NR, all those sorts of things. I mean, I was wondering, you've talked about taking creatine, you've talked about taking omega-3s if you're not eating as much seafood, you know, salmon and stuff like that. Are there any supplements that you regularly take? Oh, you mentioned B vitamins, you mentioned vitamin D, magnesium, you mentioned quite a few, but are there any in terms of sort of people would think of them as longevity supplements? So those that I mentioned, NR, NMN, you know, those sorts of things that you would take or you do take, or that you know, do you have any sort of views on them at this stage?
Yeah. So I think the NAD story is interesting. That's why we take NR or NMN, is to try and increase cellular NAD stores. Which do decline with time, and at least in some rodent studies and maybe some early human studies, if you replenish them, you can recover some function that's associated that you might lose during aging. What I think is more interesting is to think about why NAD declines in the first place. So NAD in general is generated through the kynurenine pathway, which has tryptophan as its initial, it's an amino acid that gets fed into it, and a whole bunch of stuff happens, and then eventually it turns to NAD. Or NAD can also be generated from B vitamins. So NMN and NR are compounds that are some form of niacin, which is vitamin B3. So first of all, that's another B vitamin. It's important to make sure that you're making enough, and then making sure that this pathway to produce NAD, this other pathway, the kynurenine pathway, is in good shape. And what happens is that when you're stressed or chronically inflamed or these other things, right, then your kynurenine pathway goes down a different road and your tryptophan doesn't come and turn into NAD. So it's basically then thinking, well, can we do things to improve chronic stress conditions? If we have a chronic inflammatory condition, like an autoimmune condition, can we help to treat that, right? Those things are going to be important. Then, you know, we already mentioned nutrient status. There are a whole bunch of nutrients that are important for this whole pathway. So just making sure that you're eating like a nutrient-dense, high-quality diet. And then the turnover of NAD is regulated by circadian rhythm. So again, we're then thinking about high-quality sleep and these kinds of things to allow NAD to be recovered and regenerated. So yes, I know NAD is important. I think these supplements will have a role to play in the future. I don't think the evidence is good enough yet that I would take them. But I, all the other things that surround NAD metabolism are things we have control over and are related to the lifestyle factors we've already talked about. So that's where I'd focus my efforts, because I know even if it doesn't improve NAD, I still know it's going to improve health and longevity because of all the other things that those activities will do. So that's kind of how I think about those. Other things that are interesting are certainly like plant polyphenols and other things that have some increasing evidence to support them. So certainly berry anthocyanins, I think are really interesting, particularly for cognitive function. I didn't mention them earlier, but blueberries, particularly wild blueberries or bilberries that have a high anthocyanin content, I would consume those in high quantities, like a cup or two a day after a concussion. And there's some nice evidence that they can improve cognitive function even in just like regular people. So anthocyanins, I think, are interesting. Some related berry polyphenols, things like fercetin or quercetin, they are thought to be senolytics, right? So they might help eliminate senescent cells that can be sort of like pro-inflammatory aging cells. I wouldn't supplement with those personally right now. I've kind of played around with them, but it's really hard to tell if they're showing any benefit. There's no measurable marker that I can use to say, yes, this is helping. But I think there's more evidence that's going to come out on those in the future. And so I think those are super promising. Other things like ergothioneine, which you get from mushrooms, there's some interesting evidence there. And then spermidine, which comes from wheat germ, and the related compounds like spermine and putrescine. I know some people who are doing some research in there as well. And I also think that's interesting. I will say that there was a period of time when I took a high dose spermidine supplement just to see if it had any effect. And I actually felt some improvements in cognitive function, like could have all been placebo. There isn't a bunch of evidence to support it, but I think it's interesting enough to say, you know, I think some more research is going to come in that area. So most of these things are compounds that you would get from mainly certain types of plants. If you consume those plants in their natural state, you can probably get doses that are having benefit, right? So you don't have to take a really highly concentrated blueberry extract. You can just eat a big handful of blueberries, right? And then the reason why I like that kind of thing is because it's perfectly safe. It's super low risk. And at the end of the day, the worst thing that happened was you had some nice blueberries, right? Even if none of the other benefits happened, you probably enjoyed eating some blueberries, and that's great.
And you've got to eat something, right?
Yeah, you've got to eat something.
So, yeah.
So those are the kinds of compounds and supplements that I'm interested in, and you could actually probably get most of the benefits just from eating them in reasonable quantities as part of your diet.
Yeah, that's really, it's a very sort of measured, considered approach. Is there anything that we haven't covered that you do take, for example, in terms of sort of supplements or food that you mentioned choline, so we're thinking stuff like eggs are great,
but also lecithin from sunflower or soy also. And so these, it's not just choline as phosphatidylcholine, it's also phosphatidylserine, which it's these phospholipid precursors that help to they create the head group so that things like omega-3s can sit in the cell wall. So you need to make sure that you have adequate choline or serine or phosphatidylserine that you can get from particularly egg yolks and lecithin. So if you're plant-based, you can just have a scoop of soy or sunflower lecithin. And these are really important for that kind of cellular structure to make sure that omega-3s are doing the job that you want them to do. So I didn't mention I take a pretty reasonable multivitamin.
Okay, because evidence has been sort of back and forth on that, right? In terms of the efficacy of multivitamins, yeah.
Yeah, and the one that I take has pretty much all the vitamins are derived from food in some way or another, so they're in the most bioavailable form. I think it covers my bases. My diet is pretty good. I certainly don't think there's any harm there. And there are some trace nutrients, things like molybdenum and stuff like that, that lithium, that may have some benefits, but are kind of hard to pick up from the diet sometimes. So I think it just covers my bases. I don't think everybody needs to take one, but I do take one. But I think I mentioned everything else that I take regularly.
And on diet, you mentioned high protein, and people are going to sort of, you know, are going to take that. That could mean sort of several different things. So I was wondering sort of how you define that. And obviously, protein is going to be super important for muscle mass. Obviously, tryptophan is an essential. Yeah. Is it an essential? I mean, it's an amino acid.
Yeah.
Which you mentioned earlier. How high are we talking? And I suppose the last thing, because you're qualified to talk about this as a physician, maybe people will still say to me, high protein diets, oh, they're not very good for you. Damage your kidneys. You leach your calcium from your bones. So wondering if you could, I don't want to lead you here, but put that to bed is what I was going to say.
Yeah.
How high is high?
First, I will say that as a physician, I'm not qualified to talk about nutrition at all because we're not taught anything about nutrition in medical school.
Exactly,
So I guess I have to get that out of the way first. Second is, there's basically no evidence that high protein diets are bad for you in any respect. And most of the studies that suggest that are very poorly done epidemiology, or they've given individuals something else along with the protein that could equally have been causing some of the negative effects. There are studies where individuals are eating more than 4 grams per kilo per day of protein.
That's a hell of a lot.
That's a lot, and that's hard to do with no detectable. Don't do that,
you'd have to really go out of your way to hammer
a bunch of supplements, protein shakes, all that. No detectable negative effects. The sort of the meta regressions where you look across a broad range of studies and kind of see where's the best effect in terms of particularly muscle mass and muscle strength, which we really care about as we get older. And as we get older, there's this thing called anabolic resistance where you might need more protein to maintain a given level of muscle mass or muscle strength. So particularly as people get older, I think they should maybe increase their protein intake even more. But the most of the benefits you'll see if you eat about 1.2 grams per kilo of body weight of protein per day. The peak, or where you like start to see a leveling off, right? So is somewhere around 1.5 to 1.6 grams per kilo of body weight per day. Above that, most people don't really need to consume more than that unless they are an athlete or in a significant caloric deficit. Then maybe it helps to eat closer to like 1.8 grams per kilo per day, you know, or maybe even a little bit more. But that's kind of, there isn't a huge amount of evidence to support that. It's just kind of like theoretical. If the standard recommendations are 0.8 grams per kilo per day, I'm recommending the lowest level to be 1.2. That's probably what most people would consider a high protein diet. I definitely eat at the upper end of that. I could not tell you how much protein I eat because I have literally never counted a macro in my life. So I have no idea. But I probably eat somewhere in that 1.6 to 1.8 grams per kilo per day would be my guess. So something like, I probably eat 180 to 200 grams of protein a day, something like that.
So if you weigh just over 100 kilos, yeah, we're talking. Okay.
Yeah.
So a decent amount, but not a sort of obscene level. Right. Okay. That's achievable through diet and maybe the old protein shake, right?
Sometimes I'll have a protein bar. I eat like all of my meals are protein focused. Like the protein is the first thing that goes on the plate. But I don't take a bunch of protein supplements. I eat a lot of like yogurt, low fat yogurt, which has a bunch of protein in it, a lot of eggs, a lot of lean meats. You can do it with supplements, protein shakes and stuff. And occasionally I'll have protein bars for snacks and things like that. But certainly don't have to reach those levels. You certainly don't have to supplement.
That's really useful. I think we've covered an awful lot. So, and I'm conscious of your time, and you've been very generous with it. So, Is there anything that I've neglected to ask that you hoped I might, or anything that you wish I'd asked, or anything along those lines, or anything sort of, you have your own podcast, but anything further that you'd like to say?
No, I don't think so. I mean, you mentioned the podcast, so the Better Brain Fitness podcast. I do this with Josh Turknet, who's a neurologist I mentioned right at the beginning of the show. It's a question and answer format. So if you have a question, you can head to the homepage of the podcast. You can submit a question, then we'll answer it, and then other people can hear the answer as well. But no, I don't think there's anything that we missed out.
Okay, well, Tommy, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it. And we'll link to all the places where people can find you. So
great.
Don't worry about that. And I'm sure people will be anxious to find out more. But thank you so much. It's been great.
Thank you. Really enjoyed this. It was a lot of fun.
Thank you for listening to the Unfiltered Podcast. If you've got this far, I hope you won't mind if I ask you to leave a 5-star review when you get the chance. We'd really appreciate it. And don't forget, you can access all of our exclusive Unfiltered video interviews and features at unfilteredonline.com and the Unfiltered Extra YouTube channel. See you next time.